I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written several interesting pieces on manufacturing jobs in this country. And one of his articles for 538 goes like this: a plea to presidential candidates, stop talking about bringing manufacturing jobs from China. In fact, talk a lot less about manufacturing. Period. He says it's understandable that voters are angry about trade, that we've lost more than 4.5 million manufacturing jobs since NAFTA took effect in 1994. But this isn't all that is going on. Manufacturers may be coming back, but the jobs have not been coming back. And that is because of factories being built here are heavily automated. They're employing a small fraction of the workers that they would have a generation ago. And another piece he wrote said that Americans don't really miss manufacturing. What they miss are unions, because those jobs used to pay enough money so that you could support a family on those jobs. And now what we have are many more people in the service sector, and more than 80%, as a matter of fact, of all private jobs now in the service sector, and those jobs aren't paying well. So let's talk about all of this rather troubling news and how the presidential candidates are addressing something that maybe isn't very realistic. Ben Castleman is the chief economics writer for 538. He's also an adjunct professor at the City University of New York, Graduate School of Journalism. Our phone number, I think this topic you're going to want to call in. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, they haven't stopped talking about bringing manufacturing jobs from China, have they, Ben?
No, it continues to be a major focus of really all of the remaining presidential candidates, certainly Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. It's almost like they don't read my columns and listen to my advice.
Well, you need to send them to everybody so they'll change the focus of the conversation, right?
It has been just a consistent focus. I mean, of course, this is something we've heard from political candidates for a long time.
Right.
I think it's been a particular focus in this cycle, certainly something that underlies a lot of what Donald Trump talks about. It's something that's been a major focus for Bernie Sanders, and then although Hillary Clinton talks about it maybe a little bit less, you know, she's certainly not one to avoid a photo op at a factory. The sort of manufacturing and trade, obviously closely related issues, have just been really central to the whole campaign on both sides.
And as you remind us, this figure really struck me, that President Obama pledged during his reelection campaign to create a million manufacturing jobs. He's still about 700,000 jobs short of that goal.
Yeah, we have seen a real rebound in manufacturing since the recession, and I mean, I think that's something that's important to acknowledge. And we've gained something like 800,000 manufacturing jobs in the recovery. That stretches back to President Obama's first term, but we're still far below where we were, about 1.5 million jobs below where we were before the recession began. We're way down since NAFTA, and going back even further. And yeah, I mean, Obama in his reelection campaign said, he wanted to create a million jobs, manufacturing jobs, in his second term. And barring something truly miraculous over the last few months of it, he's going to fall well short of that goal.
Mm-hmm. The other really big problem that you write so eloquently about, and it's depressing to read this, I don't know what we do about it, but it's part of all of the outrage that we're seeing this presidential year, that's many, you see, Berkeley study that showed that a third of production workers earn so little that their families receive some form of public assistance like food stamps or the earned income tax credit. There's something wrong with that, Ben.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that this gets to just something that I think we'll get a chance to talk about more over the course of this, but that, we have this image in our heads of manufacturing jobs as being, good jobs, especially good jobs for people
right.
without a college degree,
mm-hmm.
Both in terms of pay and in terms of benefits and stability. And, you know, there's a significant way in which that's not true anymore. And so, you know, you cite that study that, you know, a third of families in manufacturing are on some form of public benefit. But, you know, the median wage for manufacturing production jobs is only about $16 an hour. And that's below the median wage for jobs overall. It's a little bit better than you might get in a lot of service sector jobs that, you know, are typically available to less educated workers. But, I mean, you know, these are not gold-plated jobs by any stretch of the imagination. And I think we sort of have this idea in our head that they still are. And it just is not true anymore.
And break down for us, please, the regional differences and also the union, non-union differences in wages.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a really big issue. You know, manufacturing jobs, you know, do tend to pay better in the Midwest than in the Southeast. And, of course, union jobs pay significantly better. And those two things are linked. You know, Midwest manufacturing jobs are still significantly union, although not nearly as heavily unionized as they were a couple of decades ago. You know, in the Southeast, where we've seen a lot of manufacturing job growth and you know, really a legitimate manufacturing renaissance in the Southeast to some degree, you know, those jobs are almost all non-union. And they pay less as a result. But of course, you know, even union jobs now, you have these tiered wage structures in a lot of cases, so that new workers coming in, even if they have union protections, are not earning as much as you know, the previous generation of workers did.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen such a change here. Cite these figures. I don't know what we do now about service sector wages, but you talk about why people are angry. When you look at, you talk about 1994, 3.5 million more Americans working in manufacturing than in retail, and today those numbers are reversed and the gap is widening. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, almost exactly reversed. It's really striking. And you know, that's the fact that it sort of lines up that perfectly is a little bit coincidental, but it's absolutely the case, right? We're moving to a service sector economy, and I think we all know that, but the numbers are pretty striking. And, you know, I think that this sort of poses a real question for policymakers and for politicians. And, you know, so we hear a lot about trying to bring back manufacturing jobs and support manufacturing, and there are certainly things that we can do to at least try to stem the flow of jobs out of the country and to try to, you know, make sure that manufacturing remains strong in this country. But we are not going to, under any realistic scenario or really any desirable scenario, go back to the manufacturing-based economy that we had in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to have a service-based economy, then the question becomes, how do we make sure that there are service sector jobs that play the role that manufacturing used to
mm-hmm.
play? And there's no inherent reason that service sector jobs can't be good jobs in this country. There's no reason that you can't have decent wages and benefits and stability in the service sector in a way that we once did in the manufacturing sector. And so, you know, I would love to see candidates talk more about how they're going to make good service sector jobs rather than sort of continuing to make what are really ultimately false promises about what they can do for manufacturing.
Well, you have to do that, right? Or people aren't going to make the economy go if you don't have any money to buy things to spur the economy. If you've got 80% of all private jobs in the service sector and you're not making enough money to buy the goods that you need to make America strong, people have to address that, don't they? Or what does it mean for our future?
Well, and we have seen in the recovery, and this continues a trend that goes back before then, about it a sort of a hollowing out, right? That we see, we sometimes hear that there, you know, that the recovery isn't creating any good jobs, and that's not quite true. The recovery has created high wage jobs, and it's created low wage jobs. What it hasn't done is really created those middle tier of jobs that are sort of the basis for the mm-hmm. for the middle class, and so, you know, that's what's missing there, is this sort of notion of, hey, this is a job that I can get with a high school degree, with a certificate, maybe with an associate's degree, that I can, you know, provide for my family with. And those jobs are still really absent from the recovery and really have been disappearing for, you know, a prolonged period of time.
So what would you have to make per hour or per year to be in that tier, Ben?
So it varies significantly in different parts of the country. You know, I'm sitting here in New York City, and to be in the middle here is a pretty different question than in some lower cost parts
right.
of the country.
But costs, you know, a lot to live broadly, where you are.
Yeah, don't ask me about my rent here.
But, yeah, I know.
But no, we're talking about, you know, you hear about the Fight for 15 movement across the country right now. And, you know, talking about trying to get to a $15 minimum wage. But, you know, even $15 is not anything close to a middle-class wage anywhere in this country. And mm-hmm. it certainly isn't in some of the more expensive places. You know, in order to get the kind of job that really is going to support a family, you know, you're certainly talking about hourly wages that are north of $20 an hour.
Mm-hmm. And are there jobs being created in this country now? And if so, what are they that pay that well?
I mean, there certainly are. There certainly are those jobs, and there are some interesting places where you do see the emergence of some of these kind of middle-tier jobs. A lot of them are in the healthcare sector. A lot of them require some level of post-secondary education, but not necessarily a bachelor's degree. And we see some places where technology has allowed the creation of middle-class or middle-skill jobs. In addition, you know, we hear a lot about technology destroying those jobs. But, you know, there certainly exist in the technology space, in IT, or even in healthcare. You know, one example I love to give is, you know, most of your listeners will probably remember, you know, the Human Genome Project and the sort of amazing amount of, you know, years of work from doctoral students and professors to decode the human genome. Well, now that work, if you want to decode a genome, can be done by people with an associate degree. And so we've created a tier of jobs there of middle class, middle skill jobs for people with a decent amount of education but short of a bachelor's degree. That you know, can provide some of the role that manufacturing used to play, but the problem there is it's not nearly on that scale,
mm-hmm.
right? We're talking millions and millions of jobs, fewer than there.
Right.
In the 1950s, manufacturing accounted for 1 in 3 U.S. jobs, and it's about 1 in 12 now. It's higher than that in Wisconsin and in much of the Midwest, but right, you're still far down from where you were, in the 1950s.
Yeah. Just a sidebar, it's not a total sidebar, but you mentioned living in New York, and we were talking about differences in how much it costs to live in various places, in union jobs and lower pay in certain areas. But I wonder, how do people live in New York? I was just there a few weeks ago and found out how much the rents were, and I'm thinking, how can people survive in certain parts of this country on incomes that aren't that great, Ben?
Well, you know, this is one of the things I think that has been really interesting in this, in the minimum wage debate, has been that, you know, we've heard about, you know, the push for sort of a $15 national minimum wage, and I think there are real questions about whether $15 is a reasonable rate in, you know, some sort of lower cost parts of the country. It certainly means something very different in New York City, in
sure.
San Francisco, in Washington, D.C. And, you know, it is striking that wages for low-wage workers are really not that much higher in, say, New York City than they are in Buffalo, upstate here, just to give an example. And so, you know, what you end up with is people with often very, very long commutes coming in on public transit that involves, you know, taking a couple of buses to a subway and you know, long commutes, you know, certainly living in shared living conditions. But we do also see that in most sectors, you know, wages are higher in a place like New York. And so, you know, certainly, media and finance that are big in New York City pay well, but even other professions, you know, do tend to pay, more in a place like New York. And so there is some offsetting of those higher costs.
Well, let's go to phone calls. I would imagine we're going to get a lot of them. Our guest is Ben Castleman. He is chief economics writer for 538, adjunct professor at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. Written some very interesting pieces that take in a lot of areas, a plea to presidential candidates to really stop talking about bringing manufacturing jobs back from China, even though some have come back, and we could talk more about that. In fact, he says, talk a lot less about manufacturing, period. The U.S. is now a service-based economy. It's time candidates started talking about making that economy work for workers rather than pining for one that is never coming back. So let's take in all of this. Let's take in the loss of unions and whether or not part of the answer is a resurgence in unions in this country. How do we get to a point where people are able to do jobs that allow them to not have to ask for benefits in order to make ends meet, in order to live? What's happened to manufacturing jobs? What about service jobs? Now 80% of the private sector, that's huge. How do we make those jobs pay enough? And what's been your personal experience in all of these areas as a union worker, as a non-union worker, somebody who used to be union and is no longer? What's happened to your pay? What is it we do? And I think a lot of candidates are kind of missing the mark with not responding to this angst that workers are feeling in this country. So what do you think? Will you call us, please? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Starting our calls for Ben Castleman with Rich in Two Rivers. Hi, Rich.
Hi, beautiful day, isn't it?
It is a beautiful day. Beautiful day.
I bet you it's even prettier for people that have health care.
Yes.
Yeah, I've worked 30 years in the health care field, dedicated my life, and I decided to settle down here in Wisconsin 5 years ago. And I work for a company, which I won't say their name, and they give me exactly, I have four rehab directors that want me to work for them, and they give me exactly 29 hours so they don't have to give me benefits. As they hire younger people with less experience. So try to figure that out.
Figure that out, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly see, see that. You know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of talk after the passage of the Affordable Care Act about, you know, whether companies would try to cap workers' hours at 29 hours a week to avoid needing to offer health insurance under the law. And we are clearly seeing that. You know, we have not seen a decline in full-time employment as a whole, but you certainly see some evidence that, people who might have been at 30 to 35 hours are kind of getting held back there at 29 hours in order to avoid going over that cap or trying to count people as contractors when they should be employees. And, you know, I think, again, this speaks to this sort of changing relationship between workers and their employers, that there's not the same sort of assumption that there'd be an opportunity to stick around the company a long time, work your way up through it, get benefits and stability. You know, that kind of compact has broken down to some degree.
Thank you very much, Rich, for your call. Margie is next in Turtle Lake. Hi, Margie. Margie, are you there? Margie? All right. I'm sorry. Call us back. We lost you somehow. Alice in Sheboygan. Hi.
Hi. I was calling. I'm still fascinated with the period in our history where we had the WPA workers doing great projects. But I would think it would be nice to bring that up into a profit making way where we look right here in this state at our water industry. That's going to be needed all over the world. You have like Badger meters. I'm thinking that it would be great if we can start to pursue or maybe become a lead state in the water industry since we are surrounded by water, and think more and more of that kind of an industry.
Ben?
So, I mean, I think there are a couple of points there. I mean, so one is that there's a lot of economic research that supports the idea of states and even more so kind of metro areas focusing on particular things that they have a strength in And so, I mean, sometimes that's obvious, right? Sometimes it's technology in the Silicon Valley area, or you know, cars in Detroit. Sometimes it's something about it can be, you know, healthcare in a place like, you know, Cleveland with the Mayo Clinic. It can absolutely be something like water, which is going to be a huge issue. Water management is going to be a huge issue, you know, around the world as water becomes a scarce resource. So there's a lot of economic research to support the idea of building up industry clusters around areas of strength. That said, you know, we make a lot of stuff in this country, and I think this is something that sometimes gets lost in this debate. Is it is not that manufacturing has disappeared from this country; it's that manufacturing jobs have disappeared. You know, industrial production, actual stuff that we make, is at an all-time high. And so the problem is not, you know, how do we find stuff that the U.S. can make that the world wants? It's how do we employ people? And we're employing more, we're producing more stuff with fewer people. And so just identifying an area that we have a comparative advantage isn't enough necessarily to put a lot of people to work.
So can you give us an idea? A lot of those jobs, I would assume, are automated. How so, and will they always be automated, and will more jobs become automated?
Yeah, I mean, so we have started to see, you alluded to this earlier, we have started to see some production shift back to the U.S. in some certain areas away from overseas. And there are a lot of reasons for that, not least of which is that wages are actually going up in China now. And, you know, companies that have these really long supply lines across the world, you know, if they want to be able to respond quickly to market conditions, they'd often prefer to be able to manufacture products closer to where the actual demand is. But a big part of why they're able to do that is that they can produce in the U.S. without paying nearly as many workers as they used to. Workers here are very highly paid, but we don't need as many of them. We have a lot. We are now able to automate a lot of these functions. And, you know, there's really no reason to expect that trend to reverse. And, in fact, what we're now seeing is that same automation extending into the service sector. And so, you know, we of course see that in grocery stores and self-checkout, but we see now this is one that hits very close to home for me, but we see technology being developed to actually have computers write simple news stories.
Really?
Sometimes when you see a sports recap or you see a quick hit business story about an earnings release, you know, that may have been written by a computer, by an algorithm, and not by a human being tapping away at a computer. So this is a trend that is only going to expand. It's not going to go in the other direction.
A computer doing that? I didn't know that.
I am a computer right now. You're speaking to me. No, we're not quite to that point yet, but who knows? Watch out.
Yeah, I think they'd have a hard time with spontaneity, don't you think?
Yeah. But, you know, this is, I think, something that we need to think about here is it's easy to get scared about computers coming and taking our jobs, robots coming and taking our jobs. Historically, you know, that has never, we've feared that before, and it's never panned out, right? It has always been the case that we have figured out ways to use the extra time that we get and the greater efficiency that we get to create whole new industries and you know, find new ways to put people to work in even better and more productive ways. I think the question now is how do we make sure that that happens again, and how do we make sure that happens in a way that benefits all workers and not only the sort of handful that have, you know, access to specialized skills or to capital or extra benefits.
And what about this idea? Alice is talking about the WPA. We've been talking about, and I remember vividly, the president under a bridge somewhere in Ohio talking about having to rebuild infrastructure. We've heard about pipes, water pipes in cities all over the country, not just cities, with amounts of lead that are not safe, that whole infrastructure in the country needs rebuilding. What's the role of government in creating some of those jobs, like the WPA, for the infrastructure which is falling apart in this country and making, and it's hard to imagine the government putting forward any money for anything now or coming to agreement, but that could be an area where we could see a growth in well-paying jobs, couldn't we?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, it's important a little bit, I think, to separate pure make-work programs, which I mean, there was some advocacy for sort of in the midst of the recession, in the midst of a total crisis. But, you know, it's a little bit distinct from saying, hey, we need government to perform its function here and to rebuild infrastructure. And one advantage of that along the way is, of course, that it creates jobs. You know, we are not investing heavily in infrastructure at any level, local, state, or federal. Some of that is because we're shifting money towards other programs. You know, we have, you know, more retirees, more health care costs, and so you have priorities shifting in that way. But it's also that we have not prioritized that kind of spending. And, you know, we're not prioritizing at a time when borrowing costs for the government are extremely low. And so there's certainly an argument to be made that now is the time when the government should be spending on these at a time when it won't cost it nearly as much money as it might at a time when borrowing costs are higher, when interest rates are higher.
Alice, thanks for your call. I love the name Alice. Let's go to Todd in Eau Claire. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Kathleen. Always enjoy your show and the topics you bring up. So kudos to you.
Thanks, Todd.
Your guest mentioned earlier about not being able to go back to the manufacturing-based economy of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and I certainly agree with a portion of that. But he also made the comment that, for many reasons, not desirable to go back to that economy. And I'm curious for him to expand on that idea and what he meant by not a desirable economy to seek out. And I'm in a bad cell area, so okay. I'm going to have to hang up or I'm going to lose you here.
All right, Todd. Thank you. Thanks for the call.
So I think it's a great and totally fair question. You know, it is absolutely the case that trade and improved technology have opened up a lot of possibilities for people in this country, right? And we are able to. We have technologies and we have products that we would not have access to if we were building all of those things here domestically. It's certainly fair. It's certainly a judgment call on some level about, you know, which society you would prefer to live in. But I think that there's no reason inherently that we can't have both. That we can't have the technologies that we have and the advantages that we have, and at the same time have decent paying jobs for people. And so the question for me is not how do we get back to the manufacturing jobs of old, it's how do we get the elements of those jobs that we really valued and apply them in a modern economy and have them work with the world that we live in now.
Let me read you a couple emails that have come in. Kristen, or a listener, sends this email. One way to help is to require all companies importing to the U.S. pay their workers the American minimum wage. That will slow down the jobs leaving here. Kristen sends this email. There are manufacturing jobs available, but places are having problems finding people who will pass a drug test and have basic skills in math and critical thinking.
So I think that last point is a really interesting one, because I hear this from companies all the time, and you may well as well, companies saying, you know, we would like to hire, but we can't find workers. And I confess to being a little bit suspicious of that claim. Not completely, right? I think that there's absolutely an important place for more vocational and technical education in this country. I think that we need to do more to ensure that kids in high school, when they're thinking about what they can do, that they consider trade skills, developing trade skills, manufacturing as a viable career, because it absolutely is. But what I always ask companies when I talk to them and they make that claim is I say, well, have you considered offering to pay them more? I'm sort of unconvinced that you can't find workers until you start offering a decent wage. And, you know, if you can't find workers at $25 an hour, then we'll talk. But if what you're saying is,
yeah,
I can't find a well-trained, responsible, you know, experienced worker for $15 an hour, well, no kidding, you can't. And so you can bring in somebody at $15 an hour and you can train him or her and, you know, provide that person with the experience to climb up. Or you can bring in somebody at $25 an hour and find somebody experienced, but you're not going to be able to find an experienced person at $15 an hour. And I don't know when we reach the conclusion that you ought to be able to.
Brian is our next caller in Leaf River, Illinois. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I'm cut back for 32 years. 21 years ago, I was with Teamsters, in the freight industry, and I find myself working the same amount of hours, can't afford the insurance to cut me off, and I'm making about $400 less a week.
Ooh.
A lot of jobs.
Yeah. I'm sorry, your phone is really crummy here, Brian. What are you doing now? I didn't hear that.
I'm still driving truck.
Okay.
Doing the same job, just for a different company, about $400 less a week.
All right. I'm going to have to hold you there. I'd like to hear more, but we can't hear what you're saying. Well, that's quite a difference, isn't it? Talk about union,
yeah.
Non-union. Yeah.
And I would like to say that the caller's experience is an unusual one, but you know, we can see very clearly from the data that it's not. You know, hourly wages have basically been flatlined for, you know, 15 years now. The last time that we saw really steady, faster than inflation, you know, strong job wage growth up and down the earnings spectrum was in the late 1990s. And not coincidentally, that was a period when unemployment got very low. And if companies wanted to be able to attract people, they offered them more money, just like we were talking about a minute ago. And they were willing to hire people that they might not have looked at otherwise. They were willing to hire people with criminal records. They were willing to hire people with disabilities. They were willing to hire people who might have had drug problems. I mean, I don't think they were hiring truck drivers with drug problems, I hope. But they, you know, there are certainly places that that can hire people who might have certain challenges. And, you know, that I think is something that even as the economy has improved here nationally and certainly in Wisconsin over the course of the last few years, we still have not reached that place where there's sort of low enough unemployment and a shortage enough of workers that companies are really being forced to raise wages and give people the kind of jobs that, you know, we'd like to see.
Thanks, Brian, for your call. Sorry it had to be short. Pedro in Madison, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me to the conversation. When I grew up, and I just turned 60, we had this idea that in the wonderful, glorious future, the jobs of the machine be taken over by machines would give us more free time for vacation and to enjoy life. Doesn't seem to work that way, though. It seems that the jobs the computers are taken away are, you know, not giving us more free time. That's not what's happening. I've worked both for the state and another union job for United Aerospace and Auto Workers, and most of my life in the private sector, though. And I think there's a lot of slack that can be picked up in the unions. You know, for example, my first job at the UAW in a factory, a union guy tapped me on the shoulder and asked me to slow down. When I worked for the state, I had jobs to do that I could do in 2 hours that I was replacing someone that was supposed to do 8 hours. I'm not saying exactly like Cuba, but some slack could be picked up. Young people have enough energy to do these jobs.
There a lot of slack, Ben?
I mean, I think there are a couple of interesting points the caller makes. I mean, so one is, you know, there's certainly a train of thought that that unions, you know, make it easier for people to, you know, take it a little bit easy sometimes. And I don't doubt that that's true at the margin. Frankly, at this point, union jobs are so rare in the private sector that, you know, even unionized companies are really being forced to find efficiencies and figure out ways to compete with non-union. So I'm a little skeptical that there's that same kind of divide now that maybe there was in an earlier era. You know, the time point that the caller makes, I think, is really interesting. The Obama administration just came out this week with new requirements to raise the threshold at which you have to be paid overtime, whether you're an hourly or a salaried worker, up to north of $45,000. And so this is basically, mm-hmm. if you make under that, then you're going to be paid overtime. And one thing that may come out of that is a little bit of a pullback on this creep of work into every aspect of our lives. You know, right now, if you're on salary, you know, you may be making, you know, $40,000 a year, even $45,000 a year. You're not getting paid overtime. You know, there's nothing to stop the boss from asking you to stay late, to work evenings, to work weekends, and, you know, it doesn't cost them anything. And so part of the goal of this new policy is to get to a point where if you're going to be expected to work into the evening, well, heck, you're going to get paid for that time.
Yeah. Let's go to a Facebook message. Carly says this, as a college student and education major who would like to get into a thriving job economy anywhere in the world, or in the country rather, should I be worried about getting into a country with a rising cost of living and a stagnant salary?
So I want to be a little careful on the cost of living piece, because one of the things that has been a real advantage for workers over the last few years has been that inflation has really remained in check. And I sometimes get skeptical responses from people about that. You know, we certainly see parts of you see rents rising, you see certain costs that have gone up. But, you know, certainly if you think about what we're paying for gas right now as opposed to what we were paying for gas, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, we've seen some real progress there. So costs have remained comparatively in check, and wages are now, for the first time in a while, rising faster than inflation, not as quickly as we would like, and they're not making up for all of the lost ground in the recession. But I think that it's important to distinguish a little bit between the short-term situation and the long-term situation. You know, the short-term state of the economy right now is pretty decent and getting better and starting to show some gains for workers even towards the bottom of the earnings spectrum. I think the reason so many people are still anxious about the economy is because they take a step back and they look over 10 and 20 and 30 years and say, you know, where am I compared to where my parents were? Or they look ahead and they say, how am I going to pay for retirement? How am I going to pay for my college or my kids' college? You know, how do I build up savings so that if, you know, my car breaks down or I have a health problem, there's something there for me? You know, those, I think, are the kind of long-term problems that people are looking at that sort of give rise to the anxiety that then we see, of course, you know, show up on the campaign trail.
You have a lot of presidential candidates talking about trade, and you write about this in one of your pieces. It's understandable you say that voters are angry about trade. U.S. has lost more than 4.5 million manufacturing jobs since NAFTA took effect in 1994. Should we be concerned about that? Should we be talking about that issue a lot on the campaign trail?
So trade, I think, is really important, in particular because this is an area where I think the economic thought on this, or among experts, has shifted in a pretty important way over the last few years. You know, we have always known two important things that remain true. Trade is good for the economy overall, in the sense of GDP and kind of overall income for the economy. That has been true, and it remains true. Trade also has winners and losers, and there are people who lose their job, and those people are clearly not better off because of trade, and we've always known that to be true. What I think has begun to shift in our understanding is that we always thought, or economists always thought, that those losers lost for only a relatively short period of time, that you lose your job, but the economy is able to adjust and you find another one, or if you don't, then at least your kids end up in significantly better shape. And so it's sort of worth the pain. That's always a tough thing to say, but it's worth the pain for the longer-term gain. We're starting to question that a little bit more. We're starting to see that some communities really do not rebound as quickly as we thought, and sometimes what we end up with is multiple generations of struggles as a result of this. And so that paints a very different picture of trade. You know, if it's not a question of, you know, a couple of people take a hit for a limited period of time, but rather people take a hit for generations or whole communities take a hit, you know, then you really have to start asking, you know, are the trade-offs worth it? And I think that we're starting to see those questions get asked on the campaign trail. You know, it's interesting to see that, you know, Hillary Clinton has said that she's opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You're seeing, right, you know, the nominee or the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party be somebody who's, you know, very critical of trade. You know, those are not things that we would have seen in the 1990s, early 2000s. And that's clearly a reflection of not just this research, but of people, you know, I think, you know, real voters sort of recognizing something that maybe it's taking the economics a while to catch up to.
Mm. Well, let's welcome more phone calls, and we'll take here. Let me give you the number because there are a couple lines open right now. Our guest is Ben Castleman. Ben is the chief economics writer for 538 and is an adjunct professor at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. He's written a couple important pieces. Well, he's written a lot more than that. And he wrote them. Computers didn't write all of these. He wrote them. Ben wrote them. He is urging presidential candidates to stop talking about bringing those manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. from China because they're not going to happen. We've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. Some of the jobs have been coming back. The factories have been coming back, but really the jobs have not because we've got more people being put out of work because things are automated. So factories are employing a small fraction of the workers that they would have. We have a great disparity in wages when you look at parts of the country and when you look at union versus non-union. And he has written extensively about the number of private jobs in the private sector that are service jobs. 80% now of all private jobs are in the service sector. And so it's time for everybody to start talking about how to make that economy work for everybody, how to get decent jobs, decent paying jobs for everybody. Our phone number, did I give it to you? I do this all the time. I forget. 800-486-8655. Let's go to Karen in Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a 24-year-old son who is not academically capable of going to a four-year college and also struggles somewhat with many of the vocational opportunities offered at a tech college because of his reasoning. He has a lifetime of work ahead of him in some way. He's been working at $8 to $10 an hour jobs. What advice would you give your son, if that was your son, what to pursue and what direction to go?
That's a good, challenging question for you, Ben.
It's a great question. I don't know that I have a great answer for it. You know, I think that one thing that has certainly become clear in the economy over the last decade or so is the importance of having some certification of some kind. And so certainly there are a great number of students for whom or young people for whom a four-year college isn't the right solution or even where a two-year or some certificate programs aren't a good solution. But having some sort of certification can certainly make a very big difference. One key there is making sure that that is a certification that is aligned with what employers are actually looking for, and making sure that it's in a field that has a longer run future to it. And so, you know, these are often for-profit programs. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but it's not necessarily in their interest to provide you with all of the information about, you know, what. How their programs might benefit them, and so it's really worth talking to somebody at a state workforce training center, at a nonprofit workforce development agency, at any of a number of places where they can give kind of a realistic sense of what the demands are in the marketplace and what the certifications are that will give your son an edge so that when he's looking for that job, he's not getting the $8 to $10 an hour job. He's, you know, getting the $15 an hour job.
Karen, has he been to MATC?
He did like 1 year of MATC, just basic remedial things, and even that was a little bit hard for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he has worked with the state workforce development, and they put him in like a retail training program, and then he has been able to, this last year, work at like $8 to $10 an hour jobs, actually, in the ski industry.
Right.
But we know he needs more certification, but it's like what job fields are even growing or aren't, you know, like healthcare, you mentioned healthcare, but a lot of that is lower paying at the lower education level. So I guess I'm looking for a miracle cure, and maybe there just isn't one of that job out there.
Trade skills are an important one, and you know, one of the advantages of plumbers and electricians and you know, skilled work like that is not outsourceable. And so, you know, there are those jobs may not pay a tremendous amount, although certainly in some cases they can pay very well. But those can sometimes work, and you know, manufacturing is not one. You know, as pessimistic as I have been about manufacturing over the course of the last hour, there are still jobs there, especially for people who have skills in welding, in you know, a number of sort of specific areas. You know, and I obviously don't know your son's particular circumstance, but you know, don't give up you know, the idea of things that you can do with your hands. There are still ways of making a decent wage in this country with those kinds of skills.
Sure are. There sure are. Thank you very much, Karen. Jackie and Arena, hi.
I've been concerned about the wage, the loss of wage over the last 40 years, as so many of us have. But it's only very recently that it occurred increasing cost of health insurance for employees for the last 20 years.
All right, your phone is cutting in and out. The cost of health insurance and how that factors into lower wages, Ben?
Well, so I'm guessing here that this is maybe the direction the caller was going,
right.
that employment costs are not as stagnant as wages, in part because, you know, it costs more. You know, we pay more for health insurance, but our companies also pay more for health insurance, at least if you're lucky enough to have health insurance. And it's certainly true that if you look at employment costs, as a whole, kind of what it costs a company to employ a worker, that has risen faster than wages. You know, that gets into a whole other area which we could easily spend another hour on, but about how do we keep healthcare costs under control? Because it is certainly the case that we cannot continue to have a country where, you know, an ever rising share of our income is going towards health, especially, you know, some of that right now is because of you know, increasing number of retirees. But even if you sort of adjust for that, we are seeing, you know, more and more of our national income going to health and healthcare, and that's just not sustainable over the long term.
We have a hard time taking on big issues, big concerns, don't we?
If we can solve this one here, then we can move on and solve healthcare in the next hour.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Jackie, for the call. Jerry in La Crosse. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm thinking that after World War II, the USA was the only country with any, you know, modern productive capacity. Anything we could make, we could sell. We could sell it at a good profit, thereby giving all kinds of room for union, you know, wages, auto industry, Hormel, and so on and so on. And that day is gone. We now have competition all over the place. We got competition from Ethiopia. I'm not talking just Europe. I'm talking Ethiopia. I'm talking Cambodia, Laos. They don't have the costs we have. They don't have the healthcare needs, demands. How are we going to compete? I think all this talk about basically how we're going to cut the pie is sort of wasted, because we're going to have to fight to make a pie. What do you think?
So I think that, you know, I a minute ago said that some of the thinking on trade among experts has shifted a bit, and that's true. But I think that the big picture reality here is still what it has been, which is that the evidence is that in a global context, this is not a zero-sum game. There's a reason that after World War II, the U.S. You know, engaged in the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe, and it was not only our own humanitarian interest in Europe, although of course that was a factor, but there was an economic benefit, right? There was a benefit to having customers for our goods around the world, and there's a benefit to having countries around the world making the things that they have an advantage in that we're able to afford more cheaply. You know, there are absolutely things that we need to think about how to ensure that we're competing on a fair playing field around the world. But, you know, a fair playing field does not mean that wages are going to be the same in China as they are here. We need to make sure that if we're opening up our markets to Chinese goods, that China is opening up their markets to ours. We need to make sure that if we have environmental restrictions here, to be concerned about you know, our carbon emissions, that China and India and Brazil are doing the same. You know, there are ways that we need to make sure that we are all competing fairly. But it is always going to be the case now that there are places in the world that have lower wages than the U.S. And at the end of the day, we should welcome that, because it's not just, it's not straight one-to-one competition, right? This is ultimately expanding the pie and you know, providing more for both sides of that trade. Mm.
Ben, thank you so much for being with us. Don't ever let those computers take over your job.
I'm trying to hold them off as best I can.
Yeah, they would know what they're doing. Ben Castleman, our guest this hour, chief economics writer for 538. He's an adjunct professor also at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. And he's written extensively about manufacturing jobs, about trade, about private sector jobs in the service sector and how, in many cases, they're not paying a decent wage, and taking a very careful, studied, important look at today's economy. We thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We're next with you Monday for All Things Political. Our guest will be Francesca Chambers of the Daily Mail, who's covering the Democratic race. She's a frequent commentator on MSNBC as well. All Things Political coming up Monday at 1 o'clock. Thanks, everybody, for listening and for all of your interesting questions.